This is KUNC's Colorado Edition, and I'm Carly Huckles. This week, in many parts of the West, wildfire is an ongoing concern. Of course, that includes Colorado.
More than a third of U.S. homes are now in what they call the wildland-urban interface, where they risk being destroyed by wildfires.
We put how we pay to fight wildfires under a microscope. It's called fire borrowing. One thing that exacerbates fire? Drought. It's a part of life in the desert Southwest, but as dry periods become more frequent and intense, does our idea of what a drought is need to change?
Drought is this thing that comes and goes, and that's dangerous because we should be having the same conversations and being as resilient as we can, whether we're totally flush with water or whether we're not.
We explore the language around climate change and drought. Then we sit down with reporter Stephanie Daniel for a little follow-up on her story on bison last week. That and a review of the film Journey's End. But first, we turn to our ongoing reporting on allegations of sexual harassment at Colorado's Capitol. The state Senate's president, Kevin Grantham, has had to handle several complaints against his peers. But his critics say he's been inconsistent and even partisan in that process. They raise concerns about his ability to be fair and to help change the culture at the Capitol. KUNC's Benta Berkland reports.
Kevin Grantham meets with members of the media every Monday morning in his office at the State House. It's a time for reporters to ask him about policy and other matters. And for almost 3 months, he's been answering questions about sexual harassment allegations filed against three Republican senators. Then, during the March 19th meeting, Grantham brought up concerns about a Democrat. He said Senator Daniel Kagan is known to habitually frequent the women's restroom.
You want to talk about a uncomfortable workplace environment, or whatever the terminology is. We have people that don't feel safe going in there without going in with somebody else.
Later that day, Republican Senator Beth Martinez-Humenic filed a complaint against Kagan. The restroom is private for staff and senators, and while it's commonly known as the women's restroom, the door isn't marked. Kagan admits to going in once, but also denies doing it multiple times.
It was an innocent mistake, and to try and blow it up like this.
Under the General Assembly's workplace harassment policy, Grantham is the one in charge of investigating the complaint against Kagan, or hiring an outside firm to do it. Grantham would also determine if punishment is merited.
Some people will perceive bias and unfair treatment because of the president's prior comments on this case.
That's Jennifer Drobak, a law professor at the University of Indiana and a national expert on sexual harassment in the workplace. She says Grantham should recuse himself.
Deciding that someone is guilty before an investigation's been done really suggests that he has an agenda.
When sexual harassment allegations against three Republican senators were found credible, Grantham didn't say if his colleagues had acted inappropriately, but called the independent investigations flawed. Asked if he would recuse himself from handling the Kagan matter.
I will just have to look into it.
Grantham has also made contradictory statements about when lawmakers and staffers should be telling their stories to the media. Last month, he said they all play by the same set of rules, and he was critical of a male staffer who went public after filing a complaint against Republican Senator Randy Baumgardner for creating a hostile work environment.
A staff member went to the media first and absolutely broke the rules as we all agree to live by. Didn't even allow the policy to be in effect for that situation, trying to create a media storm out of it. So that's a little bit upsetting.
But a month later, when Martinez-Humenic filed her complaint against Kagan, she came to us with the story. And Grantham didn't say she broke any rules.
Like many accusers and complainants, she has availed herself of the press, like many of them have. It's a fine line, and that's why I'm not speaking about it now, because the complaint was filed.
That leaves the staffer, who wishes to remain anonymous for fear of losing his job, feeling like there's a double standard. Others find the remarks unsettling. Erin Hottenstein is with the group Colorado 50-50, which seeks to elect more women to office.
President Grantham is treating a member of his own party a certain way and treating a staffer who made a complaint against someone in his own party a different way. And that kind of inconsistency really shouldn't be happening. It makes the process look partisan, and this process should not be partisan at all.
The harshest criticism is still coming from Senate Democrats over Grantham's handling of Baumgartner. They're calling for Baumgartner's expulsion after allegations that he grabbed and slapped a former legislative aide's buttocks multiple times were found to be credible.
Reporting from the Capitol, that's KUNC's Benta Berkland. Now, let's catch up with a few news items from around Colorado. Starting with the details about that British company, Cambridge Analytica, which claims it has helped influence America's elections. The firm targeted Colorado voters in online ads, potentially swaying them as early as 2014. KUNC's Ray Ellen Bichelle reports.
Back then, Republican Cory Gardner was vying for a Senate seat against Democratic incumbent Mark Udall. Gardner won by a close margin, the first time a candidate beat an incumbent senator in Colorado in 36 years. And it helped Republicans gain control over the Senate. Sarah Briner is with the Center for Responsive Politics, a nonpartisan research group that tracks money in U.S. politics. She's skeptical.
Who saw the ads? Were they truly swing voters? Did it get them to the polls if they wouldn't have already gone?
She says there are a lot of questions about Cambridge Analytica's actual election impact that could remain unanswered.
These are tight elections, and any number of factors, including the weather, can ultimately make the difference.
She says the company could easily be overstating its influence. After all, the goal is to get more campaigns to hire them in the future.
Meanwhile, at Colorado's Capitol, Republican Senator Tim Neville is trying to pass a bill that would ask voters this question. Should so-called sanctuary cities be banned? Former Congressman Tom Tancredo says if Neville's efforts fail, he may step in to advance it another way, as Sandra Fish reports for KUNC.
Just weeks after dropping out of the Colorado governor's race, Tom Tancredo tells KUNC that he's turning his attention to ways to overrule so-called sanctuary cities like Denver and Boulder that refuse to cooperate with federal immigration authorities. He predicts an effort to do that in the state legislature will die.
We're going to wait until his bill is killed by the Democrats, and then I'm going to try to put it on the ballot myself.
But it could be all talk. Tancredo said he's raised no money to get the word out on the effort.
Question is, how much will we be able to raise for a campaign? You know, getting it on the ballot costs you about $600,000. Then a campaign, about a million. Where are we going to get it? I have no idea right now.
He's drafted official language for the ballot. Public comment on it is scheduled for April 5th.
There was also an unexpected breakthrough in the state Senate this week. And it could ultimately lead to billions of dollars for road and bridge projects. That could be years away, but a better-than-expected budget led Democrats to agree to add $500 million for now. So what about the rest of the billions? As KUNC's Matt Bloom reports, at least one group is moving forward with its own efforts to address that issue.
A bipartisan coalition led by the Denver Chamber of Commerce is planning to ask voters this November to approve a tax increase to fund transportation projects. President and CEO Kelly Bruff thinks voters are willing to tax themselves for the sake of Colorado's roadways.
So while I understand there may be people who believe you don't need resources to make that investment, the majority of Coloradans really do, and I think in November they'll get the chance to have their voice be heard.
The group has five proposals that would increase sales taxes anywhere from 0.35% to a full 1%. Based on what state lawmakers do, they'll pick one measure and begin collecting signatures to get it on the ballot.
And one last piece of news. U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wants hemp taken off the list of controlled substances. You know, the list of illegal drugs that can get you thrown behind bars. KUNC's Harvest Public Media reporter Esther Honig says the move by the Republican senator looks like good news for the states that have legal but limited cultivation, like Colorado.
Hemp has a minuscule amount of the psychoactive chemical in marijuana and is considered illegal by the federal government. More than half of U.S. states allow farmers to grow it as part of research pilot programs run by state agencies and local universities. Colorado hemp farmer Ryan Laughlin grows 300 acres of the crop. He says McConnell's proposal could help when it comes to gaining access to business essentials like crop insurance, low-interest government loans, and even a bank account.
Farmers live through the banking system. I mean, this is how we operate.
McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, which has a hemp pilot program, says he wants to put regulation of hemp in states' hands.
Now to fire borrowing. For years now, lawmakers in Colorado and other Western states have wanted to treat wildfires as natural disasters. Because if it is one, a federal emergency fund would cover the costs of fighting the fires. As KUNC's Ray Ellen Bushell reports, President Trump has signed a massive spending bill that will do just that.
Montana Governor Steve Bullock has been pushing for years to make this change.
Boy, I've been fighting for a fire funding fix since I became attorney general.
And that was 10 years ago. Bullock says the current system makes no sense. Natural disasters like tornadoes and floods get emergency money from places like FEMA. But wildfire response is funded primarily by the Forest Service. And in the last few years, the agency has had to cannibalize more and more of its budget to do so.
It really always has been sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Here's how it works now. Think of the Forest Service as a person.
Let's say that you have monthly household income to pay for your food, your bills, your daycare, everything. And you got that set amount of money a month.
But every month, an emergency happens that sucks up more than half of that household budget. What do you do?
So we'll borrow from all the other needs of the household, or in this case, the Forest Service, to pay for the fire.
The Forest Service has had to take money away from things like restoring trails, but also things like clearing out underbrush or making sure power lines aren't touching trees. Things that prevent future wildfires. Those activities get delayed. This at a time when wildfire seasons are running longer and hotter. Take the Colorado fire season of 2012. A mega fire was smoldering in the north. And at the same time, flames were licking at Colorado Springs in the south.
And actually burning into the city.
That's journalist Michael Kotis.
So that's definitely not our grandfather's wildfire.
Kotis just wrote a book about fighting wildfires. He says that season in Colorado is just one example of how wildfires have changed and how, in recent years, the Forest Service has been stretched thin. That's why Western lawmakers have pushed for treating wildfires as natural disasters. Now, the new legislation would create an emergency fund that averages $2 billion a year, expressly set for the Forest Service to fight wildfires. Sounds like a solution. But CODIS says not so fast.
Definitely, you know, there's a very expensive job to be done that really needs to be done. But a lot of fire ecologists would also cite a lot of money that was spent fighting fires that probably shouldn't have been fought or should have been fought in a different way. And that a lot of this money is spent on firefighting that isn't as effective as people think it is.
For example, he says, there's increasing evidence that dropping flame retardants out of airplanes doesn't actually do very much.
That's probably the most expensive part of our firefighting efforts.
And then there's another thing. Yes, CODIS says, summers are getting hotter and drier. And yes, the fire season is getting longer. But a big reason why fires have become more disastrous is this. People have been building more and more houses right where they happen.
My argument would be that most wildfires that get referred to as natural disasters, there's very little natural about them. More than a third of U.S. homes are now in what they call the wildland-urban interface, where they risk being destroyed by wildfires.
Still, Montana Governor Steve Bullock considers the proposed change a victory already. He says it's one thing Western politicians on both sides of the aisle can agree on.
Certainly there's things that separate us.
But he says whether you live in Idaho, Montana, or Colorado,
here's something that we can all agree on, and we all know that we need to get this done.
That's Ray Ellen Bushell, KUNC's reporter in the Mountain West News Bureau, a collaboration of public radio stations across the Rockies. Now to drought. One place where it has been bad might not surprise you, the Southwest. What is surprising is that part of the country is entering its 18th year of drought. And that's leading some to ask, if a drought lasts long enough, does it need a new name? KUNC's Luke Runyon took that question to farmers in the Four Corners region.
From the roof of Chuck McAfee's adobe farmhouse in southwestern Colorado, you can see into three other states, Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. The one thing we can't see is any snow.
And right out through there for about a couple miles is a great cross-country ski trail, but that hasn't been used this winter either. No snow.
McAfee grew up here, the son and grandson of farmers. At 76 years old, he now works with a rancher to run cattle on his land. And that land is dry. In his front yard, dead, twisted pinyon trees are a reminder of the last winter that was as dry as this one.
Everybody talks about 2001, 2002. And so that one was a very dry time, just like this is. This is appearing to me to be scarier and worse.
Without snow, water supplies diminish. And without irrigation, farming here is close to impossible.
Drought is often viewed as a lack of water, and it's viewed as a temporary situation.
Brad Udall is a climate and water researcher at Colorado State University. He recently published a paper with other academics within the Colorado River Research Group. It says our conversations about drought in the Southwest need to change.
Some people phrase it the new normal. The problem with that phrasing is it implies that something's predictable here. And under climate change, it's a constantly moving target.
And if we use the wrong words, he says we might come up with the wrong solutions or hold on to false hopes that the drought will eventually go away. That's why Udall is critical of some water managers in the Colorado River Basin who, because of political pressure, use code words like drought to mean climate change. At a farm show at the Montezuma County Fairgrounds outside of Cortez, Colorado, the dry winter is on Mike Nolan's mind.
If something doesn't change, you know, it's going to be really tricky. I'm worried for sure.
Nolan grows vegetables on 7 acres for CSA shares and farmers markets in the nearby Mancos Valley. He's already anticipating he'll run out of water this season. In the larger scheme of things, farmers like Nolan don't care what the dryness is called.
Drought is this thing that comes and goes, and that's dangerous because we should be having the same conversations and being as resilient as we can, whether we're totally flush with water or whether we're not.
Still, Nolan sees the limits of the word drought in a region that can't seem to shake it. In the past 18 years, a couple of wet winters have given hope that the dry times are done for a while, but it hasn't been enough.
We only talk about it on dry years. It's kind of hard to move forward.
Language is how you think, right? It's how your opinions form and how your thought processes work.
Again, researcher Brad Udall.
This isn't really drought. This is the ongoing aridification of the Colorado River Basin, and we think we should start to talk about it in these terms rather than this older term, drought.
Back at Chuck McAfee's ranch, he tells me about the few times this winter it has snowed. When he runs into other farmers, McAfee says the conversations the last 18 years usually follow a script.
We all talk about, oh my gosh, it reminds me of 2001, and oh my gosh, we're really worried.
And then there's some mention of how there might be a change in the weather right around the corner.
And that's about the end of the conversation. What else can you say?
Conversations about climate change are already fraught and could be made even more difficult when we don't have the right words to reflect the changes going on around us.
That was KUNC reporter Luke Runyon. On our last episode of Colorado Edition, we told you about Laramie Foothills Bison Conservation Herd. The Colorado State University team broke new scientific ground recently. Joining me now is KUNC's Stephanie Daniel. So, what's going on with the herd?
When I first visited Soapstorm Prairie and Red Mountain in Larimer County, there were 36 bison. Now they're 44. 8 new animals were released into the herd the day after my story aired. One of those bison is a 10-month-old calf called IVF1. She is the first calf conceived through in vitro fertilization and the first in the world using eggs and sperm from bison from Yellowstone National Park. Listen to lead scientist Jennifer Barfield explain the science.
Last year, we had the birth of our first calf that was produced from in vitro fertilization, essentially using the same techniques that are used in human IVF clinics with some slight variations. But we collected some reproductive material from bison that went to slaughter during the winter season. And we recovered that material and made embryos in our lab. And then we froze them until breeding season and then transferred the embryos. And we got our first calf this year from that process.
Why are these Yellowstone genetics so important?
Before America was colonized, tens of millions of bison roamed the country. But by 1890, only about 1,000 remained. And so to help repopulate the species, bison were bred with cows. And now today, there are about 400,000 in the U.S., but most of them still carry cow genes. Yellowstone is one of the few places that actually has pure bison.
But these bison also carry a disease, right?
Yes. Some of the bison have brucellosis, which affects reproduction. When Barfield started her research in 2011, she developed a way to rid the bison of this disease. And she used a technique that was originally created to clean the semen of HIV-positive men. Here she is on that process.
We were taking eggs and we were taking sperm from bison that were seropositive for brucellosis and washing either the embryos or washing the sperm to make sure that the embryos we were creating or the semen that we were going to use to artificially inseminate a female couldn't give her the disease brucellosis. So their main interest and involvement was from that disease mitigation side of things. And then CSU has really pursued the conservation initiatives with the project along with the city and the county.
So what's next for Barfield and her research? Will they continue to grow the herd?
Yes. So Barfield actually has about 1,500 frozen embryos, and they can be used today or 100 years from now. I called her and caught her at a cafe. She and her partners at the city of Fort Collins and Larimer County hope to have 100 bison in the herd one day.
You know, we've worked trying to preserve the genetics of the Yellowstone bison, and part of the management strategy there is to remove animals from that population annually so we can collect that reproductive material and preserve the genetics of those animals that are being removed from the population and, you know, preserve it for the future, but also create offspring like IVF1 that can be then moved to other herds or, you know, to help start new herds with Yellowstone genetics, which is really valuable from a conservation perspective.
And Carly, Soapstone and Red Mountain are open to the public, so people can check out the bison for themselves. I really enjoyed seeing them. They are pretty awesome.
So does that mean I can go check them out then?
Yes, you can go check them out
that
then.
That sounds awesome. Thanks for the update, Stephanie.
Sure.
To learn more about the Laramie Foothills Bison Conservation Herd, Jennifer Barfield's research, and the cultural importance of the bison to Native American nations, visit our website, kunc.org. Journey's End is a film that looks at the lives of a company of British soldiers during World War I. For KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, the film presents a clear view of the blindness that conducts wars.
If Journey's End didn't have on-screen titles setting the scene, you'd still know it was in a trench in World War I. The iconic World War I images are all there. Muddy, narrow pathways, the supports that keep the walls from caving in, the underground rooms, the jumbled and torn barbed wire outside the trench. The accents would tell you the soldiers are British, but you wouldn't know much else. And that's how it is for the soldiers. It's an inexplicable world they've been dumped into. In March 1918, this British unit is getting ready for a German offensive rumored to be coming in a few days. So they wait. The Germans, they all say, are just 60 yards away, but you can't see them. Men peer over the top of the trench with periscopes, and all they see is the pockmarked landscape. A couple of times, shots ring out from over there. The sound makes you jump. The film never shows who fires the shots. They come at random from a place that's invisible. In the story, a young Lieutenant Raleigh, Asa Butterfield, reports for duty. He's a cliché of the fresh-faced new soldier who still thinks it's all romance and heroism. He persuades the weary general, who's his uncle, to send him to the unit at the front led by a Captain Stanhope, Sam Claflin. The captain's considered the very best company commander, and he was an advisor at Raleigh's boarding school. When Raleigh shows up in Stanhope's trench, the kid, he looks like he's 11, finds a man who can still command, but has been so damaged by war that no one from his pre-war life would even recognize him. So Raleigh enters an absurd, demoralized world. The historian Michael Howard's described the crazy logic of World War I. He writes that to support the Austrians in a conflict with Russia over Serbia, Germany attacked France by marching through neutral Belgium. The war shown in Journey's End doesn't even make that much perverse sense, and the men are unmoored from history. A handheld camera bouncing around a set as if the filmmakers don't know what to show is usually an incoherent disaster. Here, it's just the ticket to describe a place where rationality's an illusion and no one knows where to look or even what to look for. The trench is claustrophobic, and you can imagine the soldiers yearning to get out, but outside the trench is just deadly wasteland. You go out there, you die, miserably and painfully. There's nowhere to go, no relief or escape. Journey's End doesn't show how the grunts live in the trench. It centers on Raleigh and a few other officers. They have a cook who regularly serves up tea and foods he has trouble describing. The cutlet, he says, may be liver. But another officer notices that it's not shiny like liver, so they settle on just calling it a cutlet of unknown origin and species. Orders come for Raleigh to lead a daytime surprise raid over to the German trench to kidnap the first German soldier they see and bring him back for interrogation. It's an idiotic idea issued by officers no one ever sees. The men will be hidden by smoke bombs so the Germans can't see them. But everyone with a lick of sense knows that the Germans will simply shoot into the pot of smoke out there in the wasteland, and that will be that. Journey's End is part of a long tradition of films about the stupidity of World War I, organized by military minds divorced from actuality or reason, and it's got a particularly affecting view of the plight of the soldier victims. And by the way, the Germans did grab those 60 yards of territory, only to lose them back to the Western Allies a bit later. In the so-called Spring Offensive, 700,000 soldiers were killed.
That was KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz. Thank you for joining us for Colorado Edition from KUNC. Our show was produced by news director Michael DeIwana and me. Editors Brian Larson and Ashley Jeffcoat contributed to our show. Our intro music was Remember Me by Colorado musician Calatana. The outro music was Good Grief by Ryan Little. Other music in the show includes Your Magic by Soft and Furious, To the Water's Edge by Roz Cole, and Steve Combs' Enough to Kill a Horse. Join us next week to hear what's happening in our Colorado backyard. I'm Carly Huckles. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast.